Hey, this is Eddie Spaghetti from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Supersuckers.
Hey, this is Joe from the Mises.
This is Adam Franklin from Slow Driver.
This is Artie Lang from the Howard Stern Show.
Hey, this is John from the Fed.
Hey, this is Rick Kubik, drummer from Natarone.
This is Josh Hayden from Spain.
Matt Sharp from The Rentals, and you are listening to...
And you're listening to The Dark Stuff Podcast.
And you're listening to The Dark Stuff Podcast.
The Dark Stuff Podcast.
Hey everybody, it's Dave Splash from thedarkstuff.com and the Dark Stuff Podcast, back with podcast number 117. This is part two of my interview with Arenda Fink. Now, before I get into the interview and tell you what transpires, let me just say that I made a mistake on the last podcast, and I'm sorry if this screws up your numbering on iTunes or whatever, but the last podcast, 116, was Arenda Fink Part 1. And I said 116 in it. I meant 116, but when I initially uploaded it, I put 117. And so when it first went out to like iTunes and Stitcher and all these places, it said 117. I corrected it about an hour later, but I feel like it says 117 in a lot of places still. So apologies. This is actually number 117. Okay, minor point. I understand. Remember to always check the website, thedarkstuff.com. Make sure you subscribe to the show. Myriad of places, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn Radio, or just listen to it right at thedarkstuff.podomatic.com. We are on Facebook. My Twitter is at Dave Splash. Okay, last thing about me. Now we're back to Arenda Fink. So, if you haven't heard part one of the interview, I suggest you stop now, just go back, listen to part one. Because again, these two-parters, it makes a whole lot more sense if you've heard part one. So, at the end of the previous podcast, we got right to the point where Arenda's band, Azure Ray, broke up or went on hiatus in 2003-2004, and that's when Arenda embarked on her solo career. Although, as you'll hear in the interview, it didn't exactly stay on course as a solo career. She ended up forming a number of new groups and collaborations and is still doing some of those to this day. So we'll talk about it in this interview. So hope you enjoy this one. This is part two of my interview with Arenda Fink. Creatively, when you guys were a band and when you write this, did you write songs together or did you each kind of write your own, bring it in, and it becomes an Azure Ray song? How did you two collaborate in Azure Ray? Was there collaboration?
We wrote them separately. Okay. But we would try to keep it, you know, a little bit skeletal so that the other person could add the harmonies or, you know, a melody line or something like that. So there is a crossover of styles, you know, on the songs. But I think, you know, that us, we had to keep it, the songwriting intact individually to keep kind of the level of like intimacy, I think, of the songs or personal, you right. know-ness. So it was important that we each wrote our own songs.
Okay. So, and is that the way it's been with all your other groups? I mean, I was going to next jump into your first solo album, Invisible Ones, which for just in a loose term, I would say was a little more, you know, quote, rocking out than, I guess, than Azure Ray was. It was more in a traditional, I mean, I only listened to two or three tracks from it today, so it's hard for me to remember everything about it, but it was more of a more rocking record, I guess. So when you went to make something solo, then for that album, is it sort of like, okay, now I'm a solo artist, so I'm going to say, you know, this is the way you play this is the way you do that. Or did you actually collaborate with the people that you formed, that played with you at that time?
You know, I collaborated, because that was, you know, and it was actually kind of a similar setup to how did Blue Dream. Andy LaMaster produced it and played most everything on it, but Todd was there to kind of co-produce, you know, kind of play, kind of conceptualize with us, you know, and so, but Andy really... was responsible for a lot of the directions, you know, on the songs for that record.
And then you went out on tour with that band, and with that record, I'm sorry, in support of that record. And your touring band then became your next band. Is that how it happened?
Well, Adrienne and was there anyone else from that
band? I guess that's the way it was written on, I don't know, Wikipedia or something, wherever I read that it was your touring band became, you decided that this is a band and let's make this the next thing, right? Or,
I think it was mostly just with Adrienne, the singer.
Okay.
That was singing with me. I really wanted to start, like, I loved singing with her so much that I wanted to, like, start a band with her. And so then we kind of handpicked the rest of the guys, you know, out of Omaha, our favorite Omaha musicians to
be in that band. So the, and with this Christine, did you say Christine? I'm sorry.
Adrienne.
Yes. I don't know where I got Christine.
She's my sister. She's okay. Singing on this one. There's a lot of people, a lot of confusing.
Okay, so... That was the thing, and then you became Art in Manila, but that wasn't the original name. The original name was Art Bell, supposedly, the DJ, the late night radio guy.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what was behind that? I mean, what is that something you guys listened to in the van or?
Yeah, it's always been like a tour favorite. It's like been a great thing, you know, which I haven't done in a long time. But it was always what we would listen to late at night to like kind of keep us going through that late night drive. So yeah. I thought it was a good homage to that.
I discovered that guy in the late 90s driving late at night, and it was such a bizarre show, and yet it was, you'd on the surface you'd be like, all of these people are like nuts, but like compelling and crazy at the same time.
Totally, you know?
So did you decide not, did you actually formally, this is the band's going to be Art Bell, and then there was some issue with it, or you decided let's not even...
Yeah, I wanted it to be Art Bell, but I talked to a couple lawyers, and they were just like, "Don't even do it. Like they'll be on you so fast, like you won't even get."
Because I interviewed the band Ringo Death Star, and they got sued by Ringo Starr.
Really?
Okay, because he didn't like the name, and he wanted them to change. And the gist of the lawsuit was they were allowed to keep their name, but they're unable to trademark the name for merchandising purposes. Which to me is really ridiculous. So that means anyone could make T-shirts with their band name and sell them, and the band has no copyright claim.
Right.
That's somehow what the lawsuit got for them. Which is, I don't get what Ringo Starr gets out of that, really. But you know, I always thought that was kind of strange. So I guess that so it wasn't due to a lawsuit.
No.
It was just you were sort of warned off of doing that. Okay. So what do you remember about the Art in Manila concept, and why did you want to go with a band again, or at least a band concept, when you just had emerged with a solo career?
Good question. you know, I think that I put out that solo record and I just wasn't ready for it. I wasn't ready to be solo. I had never been solo. You know, I'd always had a partner. And I just don't think that my personality was built for it yet, or my ego was not built for it yet, you know? And so I kind of had a rough time with that, first solo record, just feeling confident. I had a lot of like self-esteem issues and, you know, just like, oh, it's not doing well enough. No one's coming out to the shows. And, you know, it was a rough time. And that's all on me. You know, that's just, I hadn't done work on myself, you know, to be in the right spot to do that. And yeah, I probably should have just, if I'd had the proper self-esteem, you know, and if my ego was in the right place, I probably would have just been like, all right, well, I'll just make the next record.
Yeah.
And keep moving. But there was something like very comfortable to me in collaborating, you know, and working with another person, or in this case, you know, five other people. And so I wanted that camaraderie again. You know, I didn't want everything to be on me. I wanted it to, like, share in the successes and the failures. You know, it's kind of that thing like, oh, you can make a lot of money if you're by yourself, but who do you share it with, you know?
Right.
And that's kind of how I felt at that time, but it wasn't like I was making a lot of money. But, I missed sharing with people. So that was kind of the idea, was to you know, I didn't know if it, Art Manila was going to be like a real thing, but I just knew that I needed to keep moving. I needed to keep going, and I wasn't sure that doing another solo record was what I wanted to do.
And how did it go from Art Bell to Art in Manila?
Well, because Art Bell retired in Manila, in the Philippines.
Ah, and that's so where there is a tie-in.
Yeah.
Okay.
so it's, yeah, it's Art in Manila.
Got it. Okay, okay. Makes sense.
A little makes obscure sense. Reference there, but...
Makes sense.
We make things better. We make things hard. A shelter of sorrow grows in the dark.
If your next record after Invisible Ones had been another solo album, how much of the material on that Art in Manila album would have existed? Would it still have been there? Or was your stuff, was your process kind of really altered by collaborating with these folks? Or was it, you know, I probably would have done these same songs anyways, just with different people.
Probably would have done the same songs. Yeah, I mean, just because I wrote them all, and I wrote them by myself, so I can't imagine, you know.
They just might have sounded a little bit different.
Yeah, they definitely would have sounded different, you know, because all of those musicians in that band were epic musicians, you know, and everyone has really amazing styles, which is why I wanted to do, you know, to have this, like, super group. But I think I think the songs probably would have been the same, you know, who knows?
Right, right.
You don't know, but I mean, they still kind of came from the same songwriting process where I sit down by myself, you know.
And then you toured with As Art in Manila. You did a full tour with that band. Mm-hmm.
Well, we opened for Rella Kiley and we opened for The Good Life.
Okay.
So I think it amounted almost to a full tour. But then, you know, everybody, it just kind of turned out timing-wise, I think, was against that band because... everybody, you know, was doing a solo thing kind of almost right after the band put out the record. You know, it's like DNC did McCarthy Trenching, Adrienne did Dree, C. Bartolome did a Mount Madrigal record, Chris Sinsony, actually, you know, got married to Stephanie and started Big Harp.
Right.
So there just wasn't really any... there wasn't any space for Art in Manila anymore. It kind of, like, naturally just, like, literally, like, disintegrated.
So where did you go next? Because the, it seems like that you did the O&S record, right? And then you also had your next solo album, and they seemed, if memory serves, to come out roughly about the same time, or at least in the same, maybe within a year or two. Period. So what happened when Art Manila ended? What was your next sort of phase? How did you?
So I guess, yeah, see, it's just like a little bit blurry. But I think that, so Art Manila ended and there I was again trying to figure out, okay, well, what now? You know? And at that time I was approached, to apply for a Bemis residency.
Okay.
And, you know, I thought this would be a great opportunity for me to kind of figure out what I'm doing, you know, with this residency. And I applied for it, and around that time, my friend Cedric Lemoyne, who is my partner in O Plus S, I know he was in Remy Zero, he approached me and said that he really wanted to start a project with me. And so I said, well, you know, I'm starting this residency at the Bemis. I have this idea about field recordings. that just to kind of like get things going, you know, that was kind of my, my goal is to travel and do these field recordings and kind of like turn them into loops and turn those into songs and to get, you know, start writing again and see where that took me. But I was like, why don't we do something together? Why don't we do this together? So that's kind of how O Plus S started.
How did you know him? How did you know Cedric?
From Birmingham. We grew up basically together, you know, from age 17 or whatever.
That's where Remy Zero was from?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I met Cedric actually when I was in high school. Remy Zero was already signed to a major label at that point. So they were kind of like our mentors.
Right.
You know, so
they were like the big band of the period, right?
Yeah. Okay. And we were like their little sisters. They took me and Maria under their wing. But we had never collaborated before. So, you know, the Remy Zero was done. You know, he was in between, gigs. He was playing bass with Alanis Morissette and Ross Barkley. And so, I said, well, why don't you come to Omaha and let's try to work together on this residency. And so he did. And, you know, we were really happy with what came out. And we decided to, you know, release it as O Plus S. And, but you know that we didn't really, we toured a little bit on that record. But not too much, you know? And so then we both, I don't know why I did a solo record right after that.
Yeah.
I think I just, he had to go back on the road, I think. And I wanted to do something. I can't ever sit still or not do something, clearly. So I was like, oh, I'll just whip out another solo record real quick.
And that was your Ask the Night album.
Yeah.
Okay. And that album, from what I remember, it definitely had more of an acoustic sort of feel, and it wasn't as more, you know, rocking, I guess, as the previous solo album. And then different again from O Plus S.
O Plus S. Okay. Yeah.
I always said O and S. I didn't know what it was. So when you wrote with for that project, for the previous one, the O Plus S, again, kind of a collaboration question, how did you two work together, and what makes that, other than working with him, what makes that project different to you than your next solo album, which came shortly after that? I mean, what would you say are the differences?
He wrote several songs on that record, on the O Plus S, like musically. He would write the music, and then I would write the lyrics over it. And then so the ones that I wrote, he would produce. I guess it's really the production that I think is different. I think he has a very specific style and kind of like a general vision for the project that is outside of me, you know, outside of my vision. And so for O Plus S, it's like I relinquish a lot of control to Cedric, and I don't do that for a lot of my projects, and that's why that is a true collaboration, because I'm just like, here's this, and you do,
we'll just run with it.
Yeah, just run with it, you know. Okay. And the songs are very different than the demos, you know, at least I feel like they are. So that's, you know, I just feel like, you know, whatever makes it special is, like, what makes it work, you know? And I just feel like, you know, there's something that really works between the two of us. And I think it's just, I don't know. It's very because the Ask the Night was a completely different approach. And that was all recorded all live with, you know, organic instruments, acoustic instruments.
Right.
Steve Bartolomei produced that, and that was kind of, I don't know, that was more like a pet project, I think, you know.
The O Plus S, or you're saying the Ask the Night?
The Ask the Night was.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Is there a possibility of another O Plus S thing in the future?
Yes.
There is?
Yes, we have a record that's almost done.
Oh, okay, okay. And is it the same thing, are you meeting somewhere to work together, or are you, he's in wherever he's at, and you're here in Omaha, and you just sort of send stuff, or how is the
shaping up right now? We did the bulk of it in Birmingham. His friend that was the guitar player for Remy Zero has a studio there, and they work very closely and have for years. And so we did a lot of it with him. His name's Jeffrey Kane. He owns a label called Communicating Vessels. And so we did the bulk of it there. And now, I mean, we wrote separately, but a lot of it we actually wrote in Birmingham, but like in separate houses,
right.
You know.
Okay.
But so now we just, there's like a couple of songs like we need to fine tune. Some things that I need to work on, some things he needs to work on. And once we get that done, I think the record will be ready to mix.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you say Ask the Night was more like a project or
a pet project.
Yeah. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I had this idea. I'd been listening to, what do you call it? It's that amazing, huge collection of like Appalachian and like found recordings.
I know what you're talking about. I don't remember the title.
Yeah.
But
you know, so you know what I'm talking about.
That
the musicologist guy, put together, but. I've been listening to that anthology of American folk songs, I think.
Okay, that could be it, yeah.
I just got really obsessed with it, and so I kind of wanted to do something kind of similar to that. Like, I was missing the South a lot. You know, I've been in Omaha for a good stretch, and I just thought it would be fun to kind of, like, live in that place for a little while. So I was, like, reading a lot of Flannery O'Connor and listening to this American folk music, And then I collaborated with my friend Chris Lawson, who is a Southern artist, on the lyrics. So, you know, some of them I wrote all the lyrics, some of them he wrote the lyrics, some of them we co-wrote the lyrics.
Is that the first time you'd done that, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How was that experience?
It was good. You know, I feel like some of the songs were more successful than others, you know, as far as, like, lyrically. But, I mean, he's an amazing poet, so I really enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed putting his words to music, for
sure. Now, is it weird singing lyrics that you didn't write? Because that's an experience you haven't had yet, have you? Or, as a lead singer, singing lyrics that you didn't really write?
It wasn't weird. No, it wasn't weird. No? Yeah, I mean, I think recording them, definitely not weird. You know, for the ones that, like, I wasn't quite as connected to, I just didn't play those live.
Okay.
You know, I mean, maybe it wouldn't have been weird. I don't know. I just, you know, kind of gravitated towards the one that were a little more personal to me, which were, you know, some that maybe we co-wrote together. So it's like, you know, part of his lyrics, but then I put a little bit of myself in there too.
You got back, you relaunched Azure Ray, correct? That was the next thing after Ask the Night?
Yes.
Okay. Now, why did you guys decide now's the time? What was the thought process behind let's bring this back? It had been, you know, 6-7 years, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
Did you guys see each other frequently in that time, or what? Or were you...
We didn't see each other that frequently. I think that was part of the reason, you know, that we hadn't talked about doing Azure Race, because we didn't see, you know, we just weren't in the same place ever the same time. But I think it started, you know, moving towards that way when I was, so I toured with Rilo Kiley as a touring member for a year and a half, and so I would find myself flying to Los Angeles for rehearsals, or, you know, flying in and out all the time to start tour and come back from tour. And Maria was living in Los Angeles at this time.
Okay.
And so I would stay with her when I would come, you know, to go to work for Rilo Kiley. And we just started really reconnecting, you know, in a real way that we hadn't done in years. And it just started feeling like old times.
Yeah.
And, you know, she started, you know, telling Todd and me, like, you have to move to Los Angeles. This is ridiculous. You know, and try, like, really trying to talk us into it. And finally Todd said one day, I'll move to Los Angeles if you guys make another Azure Ray record. And we had not talked about it. Maria and I had not talked about it.
So he introduced the subject.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Okay. And it was like slightly uncomfortable at first because we were like, you know, like, what do you think? What do you think? And that was I think, really sneaky but an amazing thing for Todd to do because it really broke the ice. And I was like, well, if I did move to Los Angeles, should we do another record? You know, and she was like, yeah. And so then I told Todd, because, okay, we have to move to Los Angeles.
So you did pack up and move to L.A.?
Yeah.
Okay. And how long did you end up living there?
We only lived there for a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't your scene?
No, I loved it, but it's really expensive. And yeah. I think, like, we just couldn't bend on a few things. Like, we need two bedrooms. We need, you know, because we each need our own studio.
Sure.
Needed a yard for the dog, a washer, you know, just blah, 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 blah. Anyway, like, everything that we quote-unquote need ended up being, like, you know, $2,000 tiny place, you know, and we just couldn't afford that, so we decided to kind of come back where we could.
And you came back to Omaha, or did you go somewhere else first?
We went to Athens for a year first, because I wanted him to live there for a year, because he...
Kind of see what it was like
down there. Yeah. So we did Athens for a year, and then we finally ended up swinging back to our house that we own here, and that's where we've been ever since.
Okay, so Azure Ray made an EP and a record, and you did some touring. Are you back on your hiatus at this point, or what's the status of the group currently?
Yeah, I think we're back on it just simply because we've both been really busy with other projects. You know, I think at this point we're happy to do Azure Ray, but we don't want to force it. You know, it needs to happen when it makes sense, when we're inspired to be in the same creative zone and also the same, like, you know, zone of opportunity. And, you know, she put out a solo record, and then I put out now I'm, you know, supporting mine. She had a kid. And so I don't know, I need to finish this O+S record. And then I think she's going to work on a new solo record. So, you know, I think we're a couple of years down the road before
right.
we're going to...
No, you did tour and support Azure Ray again. You did tour again, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how was that? I mean, from just a general perspective, and did you find that there were some sort of older fans who had come out and were... I mean, what was the reception when you guys returned?
It was great. It was nice. I mean, I think, you know... Of course, there were, like, some cities that were better than others, you know, but New York and Los Angeles, you know, felt very special. I don't know, it just felt good to get out there. I think a lot of people, it's interesting, like, when you kind of, I mean, not that we were a huge band or anything, but, you know, we definitely had some fans back in the day. And then when you go on hiatus for 7 years, you have, like, people that have been literally waiting for 7 years
yeah.
to see you play. So there's, like, some really emotional moments, you know, like, meeting people that have been waiting that long. You know, they're crying,
yeah.
basically.
Now, what's your audience like outside of the United States? I mean, have you done a lot of international stuff? Do you, either as a solo artist or as your... I mean, do you have European fans, or...
Yeah,
are you big in Japan, or...
Azure definitely does. We didn't do Europe on this last one, but we did China too long ago, and that was amazing. And we did South Korea not too long ago, and that was good, too. I mean, like, we're bigger in South Korea than we are in the United States.
How did they find out about your stuff? I mean, did people tell you how they
There are labels there that put out the records.
Huh.
I don't know. So that was pretty fun.
Okay, so that would get us to where we currently are, the Blue Dream album and tour that's coming out. I kind of wanted to get for the last couple of questions about just sort of general questions about the music business and how you see it today. And because I like to ask these questions of all the people that I interview. Now, you're going with the I'm going to make records, and, you know, I make a full-length album, I go out and tour in support of the record. The traditional way that it's always been done, which is my preference for almost everything. But I have been talking to a lot of groups lately who just have decided that the album idea is sort of over, that, well, nobody buys them anymore, and you spend all this money and stuff going into the studio, and we end up never seeing anything back from it, and they want to do like this, you know, let's just release 2-3 songs directly to the fans and then just go out on tour. Is that, you're sticking with that route, is that something that you are consciously doing, or that's just the way it kind of shakes out, or do you have any thoughts about the idea of an album? Is that a dead concept or to you or anything like that?
It's not a dead concept to me. I mean, I feel like I definitely understand that point of view of, you know, that it is really expensive to go into the studio and no one buys records. Everyone streams songs. And so, you know, I guess I understand people doing that, especially if you have like a strong live following. If you can do that, you know, I don't know. I guess it's hard for me to say because, yeah, I've been doing it for so long. I, like you, I have a spot in my heart for a record.
You know, yeah, I still like the old album concept.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like a band should make a record and then go out on tour in support of it. Now they're sort of seeing, there's this reversal of a lot of young bands who, you don't really tour in support of the record, you make a record in support of a tour, like, as an excuse right. to tour. Like, okay, well, this is our new tour. It's not the way we were 6 months ago because we had different songs then. Now we have new stuff. So it sort of reverses the process, and it makes the records like less significant, which maybe that's the young people today. I mean, I don't know. I hate to talk like all these kids today, but they don't have the same appreciation, I don't think, for the album concept. They don't mind, you know, a band releasing singles directly to them, to the fans or something, or putting it on their website or something like that, or even the way Radiohead did it, where it's like, we're just going to put the album on the internet, bid for it what you want.
Right.
You know, that's, which, if you're Radiohead, you can pull that off because you already have millions and millions of dollars, so it doesn't matter. But if you try and set that precedent for someone else, you know, I feel like it's kind of a losing concept that's not really going to work. But so the album and the traditional sort of process is what you're more in favor of. You don't have a desire to just completely go DIY and just say, you know what, I'm going to release songs on arendafink.com, and that's the way it's going to be from this point forward, and, you know, I don't need any of that other stuff.
I mean, I never say never, but right. that's not in my plan, you know, right now. No, I do appreciate the support you get when you make a record that comes from the label and your publicists.
You still feel that there is a need for record labels even?
Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
For me there is, definitely.
Because, it again, relating to these folks, that they sort of view the record company as sort of like really just a marketing team, right? And then that's a lot of these labels, that's all they're doing these days, is just sort of, hey, we're making sure you're visible on iTunes and this kind of thing, and it's not the way it used to be done, I guess, you know. But you've had a long relationship with Saddle Creek, so that's, you've been lucky that you've had a label that consistently has been there and still exists.
Yeah, really lucky. And I mean, they do more than that too. I mean, they put up the money for the recording, they put up the money for the manufacturing, you know, they make sure it's distributed and it's in stores, and, you know, they communicate with way more people than, you know, I even know on a daily basis, and it's just like, I literally couldn't do that on my own, you know.
And probably wouldn't want to either.
No, I wouldn't get, I'd never write anything,
right?
You know, and it would be extremely stressful. So, I mean, for me, personally, I do have a need for a label, and yeah, I'm lucky to have one.
Now, this is a question that, that came up, well, not to be name dropping or whatever, but I interviewed Annie Clark, St. Vincent, okay? Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to ask her a question about was, and this is the same question I want to ask you, she took it in another direction, so I'll kind of ask both. When you read things about yourself and your music, and people draw comparisons to various artists, I don't know who they say necessarily, but is there somebody that you've been inspired by, influenced by, someone that you wanted to maybe emulate when you that nobody's ever pointed out, and nobody's ever said, you know, oh, I hear a little bit of so-and-so in there, and you're like, it's so obvious that it's there. I mean, do you understand what I mean? Like, something that you feel like is a big part of your music, maybe an influence that you have, but nobody else seems to really grasp it.
No, I really don't. And I don't know if... And I'm not to say that I'm not without influences. You know, I definitely am. But I don't know if mine translate in a very obvious way, you know.
Okay.
So that, no, I don't...
But is there someone that you consistently have seen yourself compared to, or, you know, like, oh, they sound like this, or they sound like that, that people are saying it, maybe, but you don't even think that you sound like that.
Well,
that,
yeah, that's a different story. I mean, Ajri was compared to Cat Power quite a bit, you know, in the early days, and that it eventually stopped when I think people realized that we were very different from
Cat
Power. Yeah,
because I was going to say, I'm not really seeing it.
But at the time, it was like, we both had kind of this, like, whispery vocals and this very confessional type singing, and we were from the same area, you know, shared some similar scenes, so... that is one. And, you know, people compare me as a solo artist to Kate Bush. And I see where that, you know, that comes from. And I even, like, mentioned it in my one sheet this time, because I kind of started listening to Kate Bush because people were comparing me to Kate Bush.
That's funny.
Yeah. And I was like, what, why, you know?
Well, because it's interesting that you say that, because that's why I wanted to bring the question to you, was because one of the things in every St. Vincent review was they were talking about Kate Bush.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you know, I love Kate Bush. She's great, but I don't sound like Kate Bush. And then she took it into another direction of saying that because she's a woman in music, that critics always want to find a woman artist to compare you to. And that was where she took the question. Now, have you ever felt that way, that as a woman in music, that people just want to sort of lump you in with other women? Or do you even care about that? Does that even matter to you? I mean...
It doesn't really matter to me. And I could be wrong about this, but I feel like sometimes... you know, when people say that, they lose sight of the fact that men are also compared to other men all the time.
Sure.
It's just that there's a lot smaller pool of women to be compared to. So I think, you know, so it's like, you're like, I sound nothing like this person, but
yeah.
She's the closest woman out
that
there.
That someone could think of.
Yeah, that someone could think of. I mean, I think it would be a little cooler maybe if a woman could be compared to a man. You
right.
know, and so, I mean, that would make a little more sense, so you don't have to, it doesn't have to be gender specific, it can be more of, like, artistically, what are you doing, you know?
Sure. Yeah, because, she took it in this, you know, the sort of, the media does this, and they want to always, you know, say, well, they're like this, and I thought the Kate Bush thing wasn't even a very current reference, you know, I thought, well... She's going towards a more mainstream audience at this point. 18-year-olds don't know who Kate Bush is, you know? So it's a reference point that is just going to go right over everyone's head anyways.
Right.
You know, if you have to pick a woman and you want to pick somebody more modern, say, what about Bjork or something? I mean, that's maybe somebody that would be a little bit more appropriate. But that's neither here nor there.
But also at the same time, I think having references that are a little more obscure is kind of fun, too.
Well, and cool 18-year-olds know who Kate Bush is, right? Because people who really dig for records and who, you know, fans of... I mean, this is when I was growing up listening to music, I would always want to know what kind of groups did the groups I like listen to before, because then those are the next bands I go to check out. So... if Brenda Fink says in an interview that, you know, I'm into this artist, they're obviously are going to be, I'm assuming, fans of yours that would say, oh, I might have to check that person out, you know? It's just sort of natural. But, there are people who still look to that. But, you know, if you go on the internet for 5 seconds, I guess, and that's all the research most kids are willing to do these days, they don't want to really dig into it too deep. But, so, seeing as how the internet has basically destroyed the traditional music business, do you wish that it had never even existed?
The internet?
Yeah.
Oh my god. I don't know, is my, like, laughter indicate?
I mean, I sometimes wonder, you know, for all the convenience and all the great things that the internet provides, it was supposed to be the great equalizer, you know? Yeah. It was supposed to eliminate the advantage of the major labels and put everyone on an even plane. And what it did is just drop the whole industry on its ass. And nobody can really is buying records at all.
No, yeah, you know? No, they are not. They are absolutely not
buying records. When somebody as successful as St. Vincent is still stressing about paying bills at her level, you know, that's shocking to me.
It. I just got my Spotify results compared to my record sales, and it's, you want to talk about shocking?
Yeah.
It's shocking. I was, that just happened like an hour before I came here, so this is particularly relevant to me. Yeah, no, I feel like, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with the internet for sure, because, yeah, I'm on it all the time, and I do enjoy lots of things about it, but there's lots of reasons why I wish the internet didn't exist. and one of those is, yeah, it completely destroyed the industry that I work in, and the ability for artists to make money through record sales.
Sure.
But, you know, there are other things too. I feel like it definitely robs you of human interaction because it's addictive.
Yeah.
It's addictive. I am addicted to it. It's hard for me to walk away from it.
I check the internet 100 times a day. At least. So it's like, yeah, it's there. And you're also like, we could be sitting here having a conversation. Gosh, you know, who produced that, that Bowie album that he put out in 82? Well, before we would have just had to wonder, right? Now it's like in 2 seconds I can find out the information. So it has gotten people sort of spoiled in that regard.
Right, everybody's and you lose the journey of discovery and exploration.
Which, everything is just right in front of your face, always. You can always just access it.
Well, we're some of the, you know, last people that will know both sides. We'll be some of the last people that will understand what life was like before the internet and what life was like at, you know, after it, because we, you know, not like there are older people that do, but they're not really,
they're not part of the internet generation.
Yeah. Really. So I think we're a unique generation, and I'm glad because, oh my God, I can't imagine not knowing what it was like before the internet. It feels like so matrixy to even talk about.
Yeah.
But it was very, very different. You know, before the internet and cell phones, it's like if you were going to meet someone, you know, at a store, at a restaurant, or at the mall, you just had to find them.
Yeah.
And you did somehow. Like, we were tuned into each other.
Well,
you know?
It's funny, because in the last, the most current episode of the podcast, the one that, 115, which yours will be 116, I interviewed this guy, Dave Rosenheim, from the band Winchester Revival. They're from the Bay Area. And I know him from back in the day, because I used to have my own independent label in the 90s and used to put out his records from his old band. So we're talking about stuff, and I said, you know, can you imagine how much different touring would have been in 1994 if you'd had a cell phone, you know, or the internet? And he was just like, you don't understand. You come into a town cold. You've never been to. And you have to figure out how to get to the club in the middle of whatever. You know, I'm confirming shows on payphones at truck stops.
Me too.
Trying to figure something out. And it's like, you know, and now everyone just does it right on their phone and a map. You pull into a town, you know exactly where you're going. It's like, you know, they used to, I think he said they traveled with a Rand McNally road atlas.
Yeah, well, I did too.
Yeah.
I did too. An atlas, you see, the atlas gets you into the city. Then you find a payphone. Put a quarter in it and call the club. Hope they answer. And then they give you, so you write down the directions. If they don't answer, then you literally just drive around and ask strangers, hey, where's the shark club or whatever.
Yeah, the whole idea of asking strangers part, nobody remembers that part anymore.
No, it's
like, well, now I don't have to ask these strangers,
every day.
I guess. Yeah.
Every day was like that. I try to, you know, I hope that, you know, like the great equalizer or whatever, it's not equal right now, but I'm hoping maybe that will, something miraculous will happen, and, you know, lawsuits will happen, and
I mean, look,
things
we'll
will get
see.
Corrupted,
I,
and people will be paid for their art again.
I've spoken to people who are, you know, my age, even a little bit older, who just believe in the idea of everything should just be coming for free. That what's the big deal if I take movies off the internet or records or whatever? It's like, so what? I go and see bands when they play. I pay to get in. And I'm just like, yeah, but if there is no system where people put money into, right, then there's no one's going to have money to, like, make films or make records or whatever. It's eventually going to get to a point where nobody can do it. If nobody's putting anything in, you know, then there's no way that anyone can ever get anything out.
Yeah.
And I feel so strange being put in a position of defending the traditional music industry because it was so fraught with problems before. And, I mean, the way artists would get ripped off and all these other ways. Well, now nobody's ripping off anybody because there's no money to rip people off from, you know? When your business is losing 10 to 20% of, you know, the market every single year, I mean, that's an industry that is
yeah,
you know, finite, you know? And it's frightening. And I want to see that next level that you talk about, that where it does sort of turn itself around and then they figure out new ways for artists to get paid, because frankly, they, you know, you can't do it for free and you can't do it for nothing. People have to make a living. You never want it to be thought of as doing it for money, but at the same time, you know, it's not a charity. I mean, you do have to, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it costs money, and there are other people that need to be paid, like studios, you know?
Sure.
Engineers, mastering studios, like people that produce the records, like, so many other people in the chain. It's not just the artists. So, you know, if the artists can't make the art anymore, all these people are going to lose their jobs too.
Sure. Because what's the point of a recording studio if nobody has any money to make a record?
Exactly.
You know, and I don't want to live in a time where everybody makes music on their laptop and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that might work for some people, but, you know, I want a big room. I want to hear drums. I want to hear instruments.
Yeah.
You know? Final question. Is it important to you that your fans and people who listen to your music actually understand your lyrics or get a message from it, or does it not? I mean, do you want people to really know what you're saying, or and is it important that they understand, or does it not matter to you?
You know, it's not that important. If they find some meaning in it, it doesn't have to be the meaning. I kind of think of lyrics like dreams too. You know, it's like, it's poetry in a sense, you know, so they're symbols, they're symbolic images or phrases for a feeling or something. And sometimes those can have a double meaning. Sometimes I don't know that it has a double meaning, you know, so I've seen some of my lyrics interpreted differently and I'll be in awe of it. I'll be like, wow, that's so much deeper, more beautiful than what I was actually thinking. And then I've also seen even people, like, literally misinterpret the lyrics, like, say, you know, mishear them and also write something really beautiful. That, you know, like, they're almost creating it themselves, you know, they're creating their own poetry, their own, like, story. And I think that's great. So I think as long as, you know, they're getting something out, you know, a listener's getting something out of it. It doesn't have to be exactly.
When you listen to, like, something that you did 10 years ago or something like that, does it take you back to that place? Or, the way you write is sort of separate enough that, you know, if you're feeling some really deep emotion in 2003 or whatever, when you wrote some song, if you go back and you listen to it, are you right back in that place? Or, do you have sort of a distance from it?
It depends. I mean, for example, you know, when Marie and I decided to end the hiatus and get back together, the first thing we did was we booked a little run of shows up the West Coast to kind of just, like, get our sea legs back, you know, before we started writing. And so we... I put on that first Azure record and started listening to it to figure out what songs we were going to play. And I honestly hadn't listened to that record in probably, you know, 4 or 5 years. And I just started crying like a baby. I couldn't stop crying. And it was a very emotional experience for me to listen to that. course, you know, after we've practiced the songs about, you know,
40 times, 40 times, I'm sick of it already.
Yeah, then that goes away, you know, but I'm sure if I wait another 7 years and listen to it, I'll have another emotional response.
Okay, well, thank you very much for doing the interview. Good luck on the tour.
Thanks for having me.
Come out.
All right, and there you go. Thanks again to Arenda Fink for doing the interview. Her new album, Blue Dream, is out now. Go to a record store, pick it up. If you still have a turntable, and you really should, buy the thing on vinyl. If not, CD's okay. Downloads are fine, too. Just don't stream it. I'm just not into that. And you know why. You know, it's just the streaming thing. The streaming utopia concept is just too good to be true. Just give it up. Okay, Arenda's out now on tour. For tour dates, go to arendafink.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been the Dark Stuff Podcast.
Transfer of data is complete.